On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Yahoo has a bad week and so does Cisco. Google fights for access to utility poles and everything you wanted to know about Metro Wireless. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 208, recorded September 23rd, 2016. Metro Wireless with Network Utility Force. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Sonic, Twit's 10-gig fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I don't guide you by myself. For that, I rely on my friends, my colleagues, my fellow geeks at arms, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is the host of Information Week Radio. Curtis, I hope things have cooled down a little bit on the right coast.
Well, I don't know about the whole right coast, but I tell you what, I spent the early part of this week in New Orleans, and there's nothing like spending time in New Orleans to make Florida seem cool and fall-like. So it's been a good time, a good week with my fellow journalists, but boy, am I happy to be back in the swamp.
You are a leaf on the wind. See how you soar. Also joining us is Mr. Lou Maresca. He's a senior lead developer at Microsoft's Dynamics department. You might have heard of them. You know, small place that makes a lot of money for them. Lou, how are things in Microsoft world?
Doing great. It's about 50 degrees here today. It's keeping me awake because we're all getting ready for Microsoft Ignite starting on the 26th. So keeping ourselves busy.
Wait, are you actually going to be at the conference this time?
I'm not, but I'm keeping all the demos going for them. So
I see. So you get all the work of a conference, but without any of the fun.
Well, yeah, I guess a little bit of pride, I guess you could say, is the sentiment over there. But yeah, they get to do all the partying and all that fun stuff.
Well, you know what? We're going to make a party of our own in your honor, and we're going to start it off with the blips. Well, I guess this first one can only be summed up with one word, and that is Yahoo! Now, Yahoo has fessed up to a breach that compromised the private information of 500 million user accounts 2 years ago. Yesterday, after 200 million Yahoo accounts were put up for sale on the black market, the ailing internet pioneer admitted that the names, email addresses, telephone numbers, and hashed passwords of 500 million plus users were stolen in a breach that dates back to late 2014. Yahoo was quick to point out that they don't have any evidence that payment or banking information was taken and that the stolen passwords were hashed with bcrypt, which should make them difficult to crack in all but the simplest of passwords. Additionally, Yahoo's investigation seems to show that the attackers, which Yahoo believes must be state-sponsored actors, are no longer active within their network. But bigger questions linger. Foremost, why did it take 2 years for Yahoo to inform its users of such a massive breach? For now, it's standard mitigation practices. If you have a Yahoo account, change your password and make sure you haven't duplicated your login credentials across different internet services.
Every year, the industry seems to find a trending bit of tech that each big business wants a piece for themselves. This year, it seems to be Wi-Fi devices. Google looks to be trying to keep itself in the game by reports of them debuting a new Wi-Fi router, which should land around October 4th, along with other announcements. Google Wi-Fi will cost around $129, and it looks to be a serious competitor to devices like the Eero. This means that you will be able to purchase multiple Google Wi-Fi devices, linking them together to create an even larger, continuous Wi-Fi network. If the device can handle the demand for a large number of devices of today, and also the need for high-speed internet throughput, it definitely can be a big contender.
Hey, the lottery could be ending for H-1B visas. For years, H-1B visas, those were the visas for workers allowed into the U.S. to fill specific positions that companies claim they can't find U.S. workers to fill, have been distributed through a lottery held each April. The government justified the lottery as a fair way to distribute roughly 85,000 visas to the more than 236,000 people who applied. Two companies, though, have sued the government, saying that the visas should be distributed on a time basis of first come, first served. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service attempted to have the lawsuit dismissed by arguing technical grounds, such as that the two firms challenging the government didn't have sufficient standing. Well, a judge has disagreed. The suit is going forward, and many observers think the decision could come quickly and not necessarily in the government's favor. So if your business hires H-1B workers, you'll want to watch this case closely because the ruling could have a huge impact on the way you find your tech talent.
So you think that Yahoo had a bad week with half a billion compromised accounts? Well, what about having 840,000 hardware devices that suffer from an in-the-wild data leaking flaw? That's exactly what's happening to networking giant Cisco, a flaw with how Cisco iOS, iOS XE, and iOS XR operating systems handle internet key exchange requests can be exploited to allow remote extraction of a device's memory. Cisco found the flaw as they were examining the globally groan-inducing exploit for Cisco PIX firewalls that was leaked by the shadow brokers as a tool being used by the NSA. Upon analyzing the exploit, they realized that the details leaked by shadow brokers could be used by black hats and white hats alike to find the OS-spanning vulnerability. Cisco then decided to go public with the vulnerability, even though they are still working on patches and updates. The Shadow Server Foundation, which assists in botnet takedowns, did an IP scan and found 840,681 devices that were vulnerable to the exploit, with 42,138 of those devices in the UK, 42,281 in Russia, and a whopping 255,606 in the United States.
Even before Microsoft gobbles up LinkedIn as part of an acquisition, they still are moving forward with some interesting features for themselves. One of the most notable of the features is the added bots to their system. Bots are designed to simulate people and automate kinds of tasks you usually do manually. As you know, bots have even become one of those features that each and every online service and company and social network are looking to add. Facebook is adding the bots to their Messenger. Slack is adding to their investment as well. One of LinkedIn's ways of integrating bots are with a new scheduler bot that can check online calendars automatically from multiple providers. LinkedIn also unveiled a new web design modeled after their mobile app, and they're debuting the new LinkedIn Learning, which is the lynda.com integration of the 9,000 video courses, as well as inklings of an enterprise tier plan as well.
Collaboration is coming. On Thursday, Oracle announced a strategic alliance with Salesforce, its second big partnership in that direction after its headline-grabbing Apple iOS integration. According to the announcement, Cisco will integrate its cloud-based Spark communication system and WebEx conferencing service into elements of Salesforce, allowing users to launch Spark and WebEx sessions, including voice and video functions, from within Salesforce. The announcement was made at Oracle's Open World conference this week, and the details of precisely when all this will happen will have to wait until Salesforce's Dreamforce conference in a few weeks. But both Oracle and Salesforce customers know that it won't be long until sales prospects, customers, and partners an employee has been working with in Salesforce can be reached right from the app with no need to look up and re-enter contact information just to set up that critical virtual meeting.
Now, Google Fiber has had to switch up its strategy over the past few months as it admitted that the cost of running fiber were all but unrecoverable for most markets. But that could change if a legal victory in Tennessee can be duplicated across the nation. Nashville's Metro Council has approved an ordinance that will dramatically speed up deployment, which would in turn decrease the cost of fiber rollout. At issue is the adjustment of fiber on utility poles. In the past, if a company wanted access to existing poles, it would have to wait until all the other companies on the pole sent a work crew to adjust their runs. This could take months per pole and has been outed by the FCC as the first stonewalling tool that incumbents use to keep their functional monopolies. In fact, of the 88,000 utility poles in Nashville to which Google Fiber would need to attach fiber to 44,000 of them to make work ready, on which Comcast and AT&T have done their part on a total of 33. The ordinance called One Touch Make Ready allows Google and other ISPs who wish to bring broadband to the citizens of Nashville to make all the adjustments themselves. As of this morning, AT&T has filed suit to stop the ordinance, which, unsurprisingly enough, was ousted by the FCC as the second stonewalling tool used by incumbents.
Remember the Google Oracle API copyright infringement trial back in 2012, where Google came out unscathed, saying they didn't really infringe on anything Google? Surprise, it's still going on. This past week, Oracle's lawyers had their hands slapped from the judge presiding over the hearings, where they were criticized them for disclosing confidential information in open court. Some of the confidential information included financial figures stating that Google generated $31 billion in revenue and $22 billion in profits from the Android operating system since 2008. We also kind of assumed Google had been slipping a little something-something to Apple to be the preferred search on their phones, but the Oracle attorney Annette Hurst also revealed a trade secret that Google paid Apple $1 billion in 2014 to include them as a Google search on the phone. As part of the historical proceeding, Ann Hurst blurted out the confidential information during a hearing, and even though the information was protected by court order. Google has lodged a motion for sanctions and a contempt finding against Hurst for unveiling a closely guarded secret of the mobile phone wars.
Hey, your ISP could drop you, and it's all the fault of the Internet of Things. Akamai has dropped protection for the Krebs on Security blog written by Brian Krebs after a DDoS attack delivered 665 gigabits per second of traffic, overwhelmed his site last Tuesday. To give you an idea of the scale, this attack was nearly double that of any Akamai had seen before. A giant botnet made up of hijacked internet-connected things like cameras, light bulbs, and thermostats created an attack so big Akamai had to cancel his account because defending it was eating up too many resources. Akamai could mitigate the attack and did so for 3 days, but according to Andy Ellis, the company's chief security officer, defending it became so expensive that the company made a business decision to cut Krebs loose. The lesson for enterprises? Take your own DDoS protections and tweak them heavily to handle higher attack volumes than you've ever considered necessary.
Well, that does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to be jumping into the bites. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And let me ask you a question. Do you want the perfect hire? Well, of course you do. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. You could own a business. You could be a hiring manager. You might even just be a worker within an office. You always want the right talent. And the right talent doesn't just mean the most competent person. The right talent also means the right culture, the right attitude, the right chance to make the company step forward. So if you're looking for that perfect hire, if you're looking for that right person, you need to post to as many job sites as possible. Thankfully, we've got ZipRecruiter. Now, ZipRecruiter understands that in order to get that talent, in order to get that bigger pool, you need to post to as many sites as possible. And with ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites with a single click, reaching job sites, popular social media destinations like Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, pretty much all the places frequented by the talent that you desire. Now, you can search by skills, location, experience, and more. ZipRecruiter will automatically match potential hires with your precise needs. They've even created a responsive design that works on desktops, laptops, and mobile devices, complete with a mobile application process so that you won't miss any potential great hires who want to enter in their information over their phone or their tablet. This means no more juggling emails or calls to your office. This means no more prolonged back and forth. You just screen, you rate, and you hire the right person fast. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses, and you can try it now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Do you really want to leave it up to chance? More than 125 million candidates applications have been delivered, and your perfect hire might be the next one. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. That's ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to the action. Hey, fellas, you know what? I have the hankering for some HP news. We haven't talked a whole lot about the giant in the last couple of weeks, and I think, well, this one's a doozy. HP has just dropped $1.05 billion to buy Samsung's printer division. Now, on Monday, they announced that they're going to acquire that printer division. The acquisition is a part of a move to disrupt and reinvent, that's their words, the $55 billion copier industry. It's a segment that hasn't innovated in decades and that HP desperately wants to get into. You may remember there was a time when there was a HP printer on every desk. Well, once we started getting these higher capabilities, colored copiers that could do everything, that could scan, that could fax, that could document file, and were all networked, people didn't really see the need to have a printer next to their monitor. Now, the Palo Alto-based HP will also acquire over 6,500 patents pertaining to printing and Samsung's printing team of 1,300 researchers and engineers. Curtis, let me go to you first. This seems to be, well, an interesting move. We already know that HP has been struggling over the last decade to figure out exactly where their profit centers are. They split off printing, because printing was still very profitable for them, from desktop PCs, because desktop PCs were not. Now we have this acquisition. Do you see this as shoring up of the market share that they have, or are they truly reaching for a new market?
I think that they are probably going to be looking at some new markets as well as extending their lead. You know, I thought that it was very interesting in the press release that you quote, there's something there that talks about a disruption of the copier business. And those of us on the computer end of things tend to dismiss the copier market entirely. But let me tell you, it is enormous and it has become more complex. A lot of companies have turned their copier and their printer service over to managed print service companies. These are companies where you pay them a monthly fee. They come in, they just provide all the paper, all the toner, all the maintenance for this vast array of machines that treat output for paper. I suspect that as part of the ongoing evolution of HP, that it's taken a look at the copier and large enterprise document business and decided that there's a play there. And I'm not at all sure they're wrong. Now, this isn't at all, I think, dealing with the standard desktop copiers. This is basically those big floor-standing models that sit around and serve dozens to hundreds of people at a time. That's a huge market, and I think that's where HP is looking for its play.
Okay, I could see that. I could see that. But Lou, there's another way that we have to at least consider this story, and that is HP just killing off a potential rival? Because we know, we figured out that printing is the most profitable division at HP. And I think below that would be HP Enterprise, and then way, way down at the bottom, maybe even in the money-losing category, would be their desktop and consumer products. So people look at this and they say, Samsung doesn't have that much market share. They've been known to make very reliable devices, but they kind of score low on picture quality, and they score low on, especially on the color spectrum. But they've been making strides over the last couple of years. Do you buy Curtis's argument that HP is looking to get themselves into what could be a large growth market? Or is this old school, well, we're just going to kill this company before they challenge us?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think he's right that I think you're right in that they're trying to buy their competition out. I mean, if Samsung is just even taking a small 1-2% of their market, you know, that could be hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on, you know, what the market size is. And I think that, you know, like you said, Samsung makes lower cost devices. They tend to beat out HP in that aspect, because HP's devices and their printer heads and so on are usually a lot more expensive, because they tend to spend more money on the quality than side of things, of the quality of the pictures and so on. So I think, yeah, I think they're just basically trying to kill off the low end guy so they can gain a little bit larger piece of the market. A lot of companies do this nowadays. And in the same sense, maybe they are trying to move the market in a separate direction. And so by killing off one of their competitors, they can say they can actually take it to the people that are actually buying that part of the market. So yeah, I kind of think it's kind of the best of both worlds.
All right. Open question to either of you. Along with the acquisition of the company, they get 6,500 patents and they get 1,300 researchers and engineers. Quick impressions. I know we're gonna see this play out over the next couple of months. But what do they do with that? HP has its own research division. They've got some very impressive technologies. I don't see them really getting a lot from the Samsung portfolio that they don't already have. And I also don't see where they put those 1,300 researchers where they have twice as many working already in their printer division.
Yeah, I think those guys, the people that are going to be, kind of laid off. I think unfortunately, those people are going to be gone. But I think the patents, maybe they might be hiding something secret down there. You never know. I mean, that might be somewhat valuable depending on what's there. But, again, Samsung's kind of stayed in the lower cost side of things. Those lower cost devices, lower cost printing, lower quality printing, laser printing, that kind of thing. And I don't think that they're going to really get anything out of it, but we'll see.
Curtis, what about you? Do you see... I'm sorry, I'm going to break into my official executive PR person buzz pitch here. Do you see potential synergy between the workforces of a Korean company and an American company that has worked extensively with their Korean counterparts?
Why, yes, I do. And I tell you where I see those synergies, and it's not so much on the lower end. It's up on the very top end. Again, the work group paper handling and printing and copier. Again, not so much the printer, but the photocopier side of things. That's one where HP hasn't had much of a presence. Samsung has had much more of a presence. It's also something that, according to what I've seen and heard from folks, that market is still bigger in Asia than it is in the U.S. In the U.S., North America, we've transitioned largely to the multifunction copier printer. In Asia, for a variety of historical and technical reasons, the classic photocopier is still a big market. So I think that's where they're going to get some synergy. That's where they're going to try to wrap those machines more tightly into the document handling universe. And that's where we could see some of this synergy that you're talking about between the two companies.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I unfortunately kind of lean with Lou here. I think we're going to see a lot of pink slips. Maybe not the entire 1,300 staff members are going to look through the portfolio. They're going to find out what they need. Curtis, I'm with you. I think HP really wants to get into the enterprise-based copier, the network multifunction device, but they're not going to need all of those people. I'm sorry. So if you are in that division, good luck. All right, let's move on to the next story. Now, Cheebert found this one. And so you have to imagine that I'm using Cheebert's ranty voice because it really comes through in the notes for Cheebert's ranty story. And that is Adblock. We all love Adblock, right? Because Adblock helps us to get rid of ads, some of which are served up by third-party companies that don't check the content of their ads and therefore serve us malware in the form of ads. We've all heard of these stories. Some of us have been affected by it. And so we think that it's sort of, well, if we're smart, we're going to use Adblock. We're going to use this company that understands what we want in order to protect ourselves from all that silliness. Well, Adblock has moved on to the next step of their evolution, and that is to sell ads. IO, that's the company that makes the popular Adblock Plus software, will start selling the very thing that most of its users hate, advertising. The company is launching a self-service platform to sell what they call pre-whitelisted ads that meet its acceptable ads criteria. The new system will let online publishers drag and drop advertisements that meet IO's expectations for size and labeling. Now, the acceptable ads platform helps publishers who want to show an alternative, non-intrusive ad experience to users with ad blockers, providing them with a tool that lets them implement acceptable ads themselves. If you didn't buy that, well, that's because those are the words of Till Fida, the co-founder of Adblock Plus. The publishers who place these ads will do so knowing that they won't be blocked by most of the 100 million Adblock Plus users. That's right, folks. If you have Adblock Plus, you will still get ads as long as they come through Adblock. The software's extensions defaults allow for acceptable ads to be shown, and more than 90% of its installed base have not changed the default settings. Curtis, let me go to you. There's a lot of words that come to mind, none of which I can say on the stream. Is this just a money grab? Is this a company that has built up trust, that has built up a user base to defend against ads saying, yeah, we were with you, but then we got offered all this money?
Is this just a money play? Why, of course it is. That almost goes without saying. But let me throw in what I suspect is some of their internal thinking. And, you know, take this with the large grain of salt that goes with the fact that I make my living in an industry that depends on ads. So by the ad blocker logic, I suspect the issue is not so much with ads. They will tell themselves, as users tend to tell publishers, it's not the fact of ads that disturbs people. This is not some sort of religious prohibition against seeing ads. It's just the type of ads, all of the junky ads, all the trashy ads, all the ads for things that I don't care about. So ad blockers going, all right, we can fix that problem. We'll make sure that all you see are good, wholesome, pure-hearted ads that deal only with the things that most interest you. Why, you're going to realize how much poorer your life was before you saw all these great ads we're now presenting you. And so they're trying to get around the problem by saying, yes, we'll solve the problem you wanted us to solve, and we'll make money in the process. That's the argument. We'll see just how valid that is when their users start seeing those wonderful ads pop up in their ad-blocked browsers.
Curtis, okay. Let's back off, because I think I have taken Chiebert's ranty spirit into myself, and I'm getting more and more ticked the more and more I read about the story. But Adblock has made a name by invoking the right of every user to decide what does and does not get displayed on their computer. And that's actually in some of their press releases. They say, look, we understand that the internet is going to run on advertising, and we're not trying to break the internet, but at the same time, we want to give some of this power back to the users. They're now going the exact opposite way. They're saying, look, we want to give the power back to the users, unless, of course, we're going to make money from it, in which case then this is going to be okay. Now, their whole argument is predicated on their ability to be better at screening ads than the other person. Eventually, at some point, they're going to allow through an ad that shouldn't be allowed through. It's happened to every major ad network. There's just too many ads and too many different ways to push through malware to prevent that from happening. What happens the first time Adblock lets through an ad that serves malware to a computer that supposedly is supposed to be protected from malware ads?
Well, I think that as we speak, there are law firms that are gathering documents and building a case for just that thing to happen. Now, Adblocker will point to their terms of service, and I am fairly certain that somewhere around page 79, paragraph 6 of their terms of service, there's something that says, you know, if something nasty sneaks through, it's not our fault. Even if it blows up your computer, burns your house to the ground, and makes your rowboat sink. So they'll point to that. But at the very least, it wouldn't take much in the way of mistakes before the ad blocker reputation would head south. And reputation is really where they live now. It's a dangerous position they put themselves in. There must be an awful lot of potential revenue at stake.
Lou, I want to get your input on this, because Adblock selling ads is like the DEA deciding that they're going to sell marijuana, or Chevron deciding that they're going to sell electric cars, or Oscar Mayer selling tofu. Where does this fall in your weird stuff-o-meter of internet things?
I like CR1 in the chat room says it's protection money. But I think in this case, it's very strange. I think they're basically just – I'm hoping there's a lot of money in there for them, because basically they're just going to lose the trust of all their users. And there's a lot of other protection out there, right? I mean, there's people that are building these tools, these add-ins to your browsers and so on all over the place that are going to be available once this company starts doing this. Customers are just going to drop like flies. It'd be interesting to see the user base statistics as they start to do this. And people start saying, wow, I thought this was supposed to be blocked, but I guess it's not. So I think that kind of thing is, once that starts happening, they're going to think, instead of it being supposed to be there, they're going to think there's something wrong with the app. So I don't think that this is a good move. I mean, maybe there, like you said, there's a lot of money up front.
And I hope
that's
so.
The case.
Yeah.
I hope there's a ton of money up front, because it's going to be going away real soon.
It's a huge, huge pivot. I mean, I kind of like that protection money thing. In the back of my mind, I see an ad block executive going, oh, That's a pretty ad you got there. Would be a shame if it were to suddenly disappear. I could prevent that. Okay, so how about this? There are people in the chat room who are saying, well, that's why I use, for example, PCGuy 8088, who uses uBlock Origin. But does this become a business model? You build enough trust in your product, in your ability to block ads, and then you promise your customers, but we do need to let the internet live, so we're going to serve ads, but only the good ads. Is this the new pivot, Curtis?
You know, I think that it may be the beginning of the pivot, because as you say, if the basic flow of information on the internet stops, then its value goes down. And this really is just a big value play. Publishers, and mine are no exception, have had real trouble with this. And everyone's looking for a way to fix it, a way that doesn't involve content marketers with their absolute axe to grind becoming the primary source of information. So I think we are going to see this as a partial pivot, maybe a trial pivot. You know, the way in the airline industry, one of the airlines will be the first to raise their rates on a particular route to see if the others follow. If they don't, well, then they go back to the old fares. If they do, everyone makes more money. This is probably the first attempt. They'll see if the other carriers follow before they decide whether they can keep making this money and start figuring out add-on fees to make even more.
All right, it's too depressing, so I want to move on. Hey, folks, guess what? We've got some very special guests for you. We've had Brandon Ross on before from Network Utility Force, but this time he's brought a coworker. They want to tell you all about metro area wireless networks. If you've ever wondered what's the proper way to deploy wireless service over an entire city, well, Network Utility Force has got you covered. But before we get there, let's take a moment to thank another sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And come a little closer, okay, because I need to talk to you about something that's very important to us network geeks. I mean, we all value gear. We love fast gear. We like great services. But there's one thing that has sort of been a secret in the IT community, and that is when it comes to choice of your ISP, of your carrier, there aren't a lot of choices out there. I mean, yes, we want one that's fast. Yes, we want one that's easy. But the inner social justice IT geek within me says I should be supporting carriers who believe in open access, who believe in competition, who believe that the best way to create a strong internet is to make sure that we're deploying everywhere. And that's why we're so happy to literally be brought to you by Sonic. Now, Twit's 10 gig fiber internet service provider is Sonic. They have an internet infrastructure in the United States, and they believe that they have the model that will fix the current model in our country. Now, too many people are paying too much for unsatisfactory cable internet. Sonic delivers fast, affordable internet phone and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Their mission, and it really is a mission, we've had their CEO in the studio, and he's talked about how this is not just a business for him. This is a chance for him to change the way we look at how internet is delivered. Well, they want to bring internet freedom to all with unlimited and uncapped internet. Sonic delivers residential and business fiber to the premise networks with gigabit connectivity in San Francisco, the North Bay Area, and the East Bay Area. Their internet service includes 15 email accounts, 1 gigabyte of storage, personal web hosting with a new domain, and fax line service for those people who still need that. Now, for only $40 a month, Sonic offers you download speeds of up to 1,000 megabits per second. A home phone connection with unlimited local and long-distance calling is included in all of their services. All right, switching from your current carrier is easy, and you can keep your existing phone number. And most importantly, by standing up for privacy, friendly and local customer support, uncapped bandwidth, and affordable pricing for all products, Sonic's customer advocacy is paving the way for a better state of the internet access in America. We want you to join the internet revolution. Visit sonic.com/twit. That's sonic.com/twit and receive your first month of Sonic internet and phone service for free. Plus, bundle with Dish and save $120 off your Sonic bill. Once again, visit sonic.com/twit. And we thank Sonic for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's welcome back to the show Mr. Brandon Ross from Network Utility Force, and welcome for the first time Mr. Adam Walker, also of Network Utility Force. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you.
Brandon, we had you on not too long ago. I think we were talking about IPv6. You were helping us figure out the state of the rollout. But today, you've got a different topic that you think the Twiat Riot should be aware of, and that is the state of metro area wireless. Let's start with the basics, because we always assume that we should be bringing people in on the ground level. What do you mean when you say metro area wireless? What exactly does that encompass?
Well, generally what we mean when we talk about that is a wireless network that covers a larger geographic area than maybe just a household or a single business or a single building. The good examples of that is one of the networks we built that we very much consider a metro wireless network is for a suburb here of Atlanta called Douglasville. It was a project that Google funded where we delivered Wi-Fi services to a couple of parks in a small downtown area so that the general public could jump on the Wi-Fi network and surf the web.
Now, we've heard of projects like this before. San Francisco tried it. Palo Alto has tried it. Different states and municipalities have experimented to differing degrees of success. And for the person who maybe has never tried to do a large installation, they don't understand why it's so difficult. I mean, doesn't metro area wireless just mean putting up a bunch of access points? I mean, heck, I do that around my office, around my house. Why is it so difficult to do it around a city park?
I like to say I only play an RF engineer on TV, and that's why I brought Adam Walker along with me. But what I'd say is that a wireless network for a large metropolitan area is definitely different and complex compared to just putting up a couple of APs in a house or other location. There's a lot of different interference to be concerned about, and not to mention the long-distance communication, right? So in my example of Douglasville here in Atlanta, we needed to connect two parks to the downtown area, which were several miles away. So being able to get up on a tower and install some point-to-point equipment was important to that project, too.
Right. Actually, let's bring Adam into this conversation. So, Adam, what would you say to the person who thinks, I'm just going to throw a bunch of APs on top of a pole around the city center, and that should cover everybody? Why doesn't that work?
That doesn't work primarily, and people run into problems with that approach because they forget that wireless runs over a shared medium. It's not like your wired network. It's not like your fiber, where you just have two endpoints that talk over some medium, the fiber or the copper, where they control the whole thing. With wireless, it's going over free space. Everybody can hear it. Everybody has access to it. You're vulnerable to all kind of problems that you're not normally vulnerable to with a regular wired network. So it takes a different set of skills and a different approach. Now you have to take those physical characteristics of the environment into account before you even start putting up any kind of equipment. You have to spend a lot more time thinking and planning about where do you really want service to be in? Why do you want it there? What are your intended users going to do with the network? There's a whole different set of questions overlapping with a regular wired network, but not the same questions.
Adam, let's deep dive here because our audience is pretty tech savvy and they understand that there is a difference between just a big Wi-Fi deployment. I mean, let's talk about a convention center or a stadium. Yeah, that's a big Wi-Fi deployment. That's not a metro wireless deployment. What's the difference? When do you cross over from big wireless to metro wireless?
So usually on those big wireless, you're serving a single user. So they don't tend to take the service provider approach. You're just building one homogeneous service that you're just going to provide over a large area. In a convention center, I hope that the person building this understands the problems with contention in a very busy environment so they can design around that. When you get outside, there's a whole nother level of problems. You don't have the easy Cat 5 runs that you do inside of a convention center. You have to build your network in layers with aggregation layers that might use completely different equipment. It's not just Wi-Fi access points. So it just gets a lot more complicated, and you have to pay a lot more attention to the layer one.
Right. And that is important because once we start going into really large deployments, you can't do everything with Wi-Fi. You start to use other bits and pieces of spectrum. Is any of that licensed spectrum? Because then we run into a whole new set of issues.
Yes, often it is, especially when you need to go longer ranges or you're working in dense urban environments where there's a lot of other people using the unlicensed spectrum. You can do point-to-point and point-to-multipoint parts of your aggregation network with unlicensed spectrum, but it is vulnerable to interference. And then you go into the licensed spectrum when you really need something to work all the time, and it's incredibly critical that you don't have any interference, then you go to the licensed spectrum, which is much harder to deal with.
Brandon, I want to bring you back into the conversation here to talk a little bit about, let's talk about the politics, because anytime we start talking about the distribution, the deployment of a metro wireless system, it starts with tech, and we love talking about the tech. I, for example, love the approach that Google is going to be taking or is thinking about taking, where they're really using three sets of frequencies, three sets of radios that end up with 2.4 and 5 gigahertz at the bottom level. But then above that, you've got sort of short-range microwave and then long-range, long-haul, large bandwidth links. What does that mean politically? Because you can't just deploy these devices everywhere. I mean, if you're talking about even a small city, you have to get approval. You have to lay out your plan years and years ahead of time. And you have to partner with someone who actually knows the area, who knows the political landscape. What are some of the issues that you've run into when you've talked to clients about these larger deployments?
Yeah, sure. So Adam and I both know very well a local fixer, if you will, is really important to getting access to the locations you need. In a previous lifetime, we've deployed some networks internationally. And saw the ones that were successful always had a local resource that really wanted the network that had the right political connections to make sure that you can gain access to the places that you need to mount equipment. So mounting that equipment is everything from gaining access to the right towers when you're doing especially point-to-point or point-to-multipoint type of networking. And then you need access to something much lower to the ground, like light poles or the sides of buildings, in order to actually cover the local Wi-Fi users. So you definitely need to have the right contacts. When the municipality itself wants the wireless done, that usually gets pretty easy, especially in a smaller town like our experience here outside of Atlanta. If I was trying to do the similar project within downtown Atlanta, the politics would be much more complex because you have to coordinate between government and local businesses, because often you need access to local business-owned assets to mount equipment to. And sometimes those are even business associations that often manage the look and feel of a street or a park or something like that. So, yeah, the politics are definitely complex. And when we do those projects, usually we're working directly with the municipality or with a partner that has those kinds of access into the local municipality.
All right, and that's really when the tech meets politics. In just a bit, I want to talk about utility poles, because that's another issue. We actually did bring that up in the blips, something that is changing, so hopefully it will change for the better. But I want to interject a fun story here, because this last week, we heard a decision by the European Union. They promised that they would have free Wi-Fi in public places by 2020. And when I say public places, I mean, they've promised to be able to do this across all of the European Union. Every city, every town, every municipality will have free Wi-Fi. Here's the fun thing, though. If you actually look at the number of cities and towns and villages, it turns up to be €20,000 per city. Let's start with you, Adam. Is that at all feasible? Can you deploy in even a small city for $20,000 and expect it to be a decent system?
No, you wouldn't be able to cover. You might be able to get a few access points in a few public places, and maybe this is politicians talking about, there will be something, but you're not going to cover anything for €20,000. You can cover a little teeny part of one public park for that kind of price. So that there's politics going on there. They want to string up a couple APs that they're going to slap on the side of some existing government building, and then call it good.
Right. And that's actually kind of the sad part. Brandon, let me ask you and see, I actually did the math on this. They promised €120 million for at least 6,000 communities. And that's when it comes up to 20,000 K per euro. here's the funny thing, though. I have seen numbers like this, not on such a grand scale as the entire European Union, but I have sat in city council meetings where you have mayors who say they've been talking to technology people who say, oh, we're going to be able to deploy fiber to every home in this city of 10,000 people for $500,000. And you're looking at them going, okay, I don't know who you talk to, but that's completely unrealistic. Why is it that people seem to think this kind of deployment is so cheap?
I don't know why they consider it so cheap. And, you know, in Europe especially, costs can be a lot higher. Not only is the cost of labor higher in many places in Europe than the U.S., but if you think about a typical European town, they're typically medieval construction, right? Most of those towns, the city centers at least, are mostly stone buildings and very narrow streets. And I'm sure that they would have a lot of concerns about how APs mounted to the side of buildings would even look, even driving the cost up even more in order to, you know, hide them and make them blend into the local scenery. And then add on top of that, that I cannot imagine that it's easy to run any kind of backhaul cabling through city centers of you know, medieval towns. So it definitely does not seem plausible to me. I would just have to chalk it all up to politicians can say what they want to get elected, and then the cost goes up later, like every other project the government has ever done, right?
Yeah, that's unfortunately, it's a little bit sad. Get the votes by promising it and then way under deliver, which, by the way, that's not a European thing. Remember, we did that in the United States just under two decades ago, when we spent $200 billion, where we gave $200 billion of tax relief and incentives to Verizon and AT&T to deliver a next-gen system in the United States, that just didn't happen, and we don't talk about that much. Let's shift gears a tiny bit. Adam, because you're here, I want to use your expertise. If I were to deliver a mixed-mode metro wireless network, and so by mixed-mode, I mean I'm using various radios in order to get my backhaul links and my short-range links and then finally to distribute to individual clients. What infrastructure do I need in place? Because that is still a question. How do I actually deploy one of these things? Do I use utility poles? Do I use water towers? Do I have to run fiber to certain bits and pieces of this network? Do I just mesh it together? What's the ideal setup for, say, a city like Atlanta?
Yeah, so pretty much all of the above. Because the environments aren't homogenous, they're not the same, you'll find that you have to use different techniques in different places. When you can use utility poles, they work pretty good. They tend to have electrical power right there. And power is one of the biggest challenges. All this stuff needs power. It needs electricity. And when you can tap the light sensor on top of a street light, it saves you a lot of hassle and a lot of cost, and you can deploy quickly. Plus, you have people that are readily available that have a lot of experience working around light poles and utility poles. You know, all those electrical guys, all those cable TV installers, so your costs there are a lot lower. But you can't get everywhere like that. You have to interconnect these things. You know, sometimes you'll have to go back to rooftops and water towers and regular communications towers, which are some of the most expensive parts of these networks, is that aggregation layer, and then the backhauls between them. So if you can find fiber that's cheap, then and you can use it and you have it, fiber's awesome. But you usually can't, and you're usually under a budget. So you have to use all the techniques that are available.
The school that I live at, we've got a building that is actually the highest in our area of San Francisco, out near the Pacific Ocean. And so they sell space to wireless ISPs. So they've got Verizon, they've got AT&T, and they've got T-Mobile up there, as well as two smaller sort of, I can't remember what they call, the metro area direct point-to-point wireless. And I think a slot, and they've done little compartments on top of this building. A slot costs $20,000 a month per carrier that wants to be up there. So, I mean, I can imagine what it must be like to try to not just find but contract with all the different owners of the various spaces that you might want to put up your wireless, your metro wireless devices. Let me go back over to you, Brandon. When I think of deploying in the city, one of the things that always comes to mind, because again, I had a nice conversation with the CEO of Sonic, is who has access to the utility poles. That's still one of the main holdups. He was telling us how they budget $10,000 to go a house. That's not a house that they deploy to. They mean every house that they pass, it's going to cost them $10,000 total. And that's very minimally is that the actual materials and the work time. Most of it is all the legal fees and all the wrangling that they need to do in order to get access to that pole. How much of that is going to determine whether or not you can deploy a metro wireless system?
Well, that's certainly a pretty significant concern. And, you know, pretty much every metro or power company that owns the poles operates a little bit differently as far as what you need to do to gain access to them. But the cost can be pretty variable. We found, though, one interesting thing is that even if you can't get access to the existing poles, often you can get a new pole installed that doesn't have anybody on it for pretty inexpensively as long as it's within the right of way. So sometimes if you're having a really hard time accessing the existing poles, you can simply have a new pole sunk where you need it. Now, that becomes pretty impractical if you're trying to cover, you know, say every household in a town. But if you had a particular use case, often you can make that work.
Yeah. I want to bring my co-host back in here because this is a conversation that we've had on the quiet over the years, how we deploy these kinds of networks, how we make it fair for new competition to spring up, how we make sure that we reward those businesses who came in and did big capital deployments at big capital expense. Curtis, when we talk about a metro wireless system, what are some of the issues that immediately come up on, say, your radio show when you're talking to an executive or trying to pitch the idea to someone who might have a little bit of influence to make this happen?
The biggest issues that we see dealt with are all legal and political. The technology issues, while they can be challenging, they're straightforward and fairly well understood. What you have in a lot of municipalities, though, are monopoly agreements for certain types of carriers. You have, as we've heard over and over, the pole arrangements. And let me tell you that the pole arrangements get even more complicated, especially in high-end cities that would seem like they're ideal demographically for a lot of these things. You see those cities going to an underground utility model because they don't like the visual clutter of all those poles. So what do you do if there are no utility poles on which you can hang all of your equipment? You know, it's one of those things where what we've had is technology moving so rapidly and, more important, the demand for that technology moving so rapidly that it's far outpaced what the legal and political framework can deal with. So it's opened up the opportunity in some municipalities. Companies like Google have been able to go in and exploit lack of these agreements. But it's such a quilt work of different ways of doing things across the nation. There are some very practical reasons why we're not seeing any huge national rollouts of much of anything.
Right, sad.
If I mention, there's an interesting way that New York City solved that problem or is working on solving that problem. If you check out a project called Link NYC, what they've done is taken those old phone booths that used to be on every street corner, if you remember those in New York, and they're replacing the phone booths with these kiosks that have a bunch of digital advertising and local information. But in each one of these kiosks is also an AP. So they're going to provide Wi-Fi access all over New York City for pretty cheap, for free to users. Yep, that's it right there. And so it's a really interesting project. So obviously that can't work for every town. But since each one of the phone booths in New York City had a conduit from the phone booth to the local manhole, that made it pretty easy for them to bypass the whole problem of having to run new cable and mount APs on existing infrastructure.
Creamy Corn Carbon in our chat room, he was talking exactly about that. He was writing, what about those kiosks? And also mentioned that the New York kind of suspended a lot of that because the APs would be using to download porn, which, okay, that's human nature and it's New York, so congratulations. But let me ask you this, because JJ to the 4884 asked a very astute question, and that is, once we start rolling out metro wireless, let's again talk about the European Union. We've got Wi-Fi everywhere at this magical $20,000 price because people decided they were going to work for free and you were having helium balloons hold up the fiber cables, whatever it's going to be. What do you do about security? Because installing the technology is difficult. Getting the technology is difficult. Administering it is a job that never ends. You always have to have someone who is updating, who is monitoring, who is making sure that the network is not being abused. Brandon, you have a lot of experience with this. How do you explain to a customer that, yeah, that layout, the sticker shot you got from the layout, well, hold on, because there's also a maintenance cost that comes with it, and that's eventually going to end up costing more?
Well, I mean, you explain it in just that way. You know, when you sit down to talk about the costs involved in the network, you have to take operational expense into account. And honestly, operational expense is usually a lot more over even a short time period in cost than the capital cost of constructing the network in the first place. You know, but as far as security and abuse and all that stuff, I mean, those are solvable problems. You know, we have public access Wi-Fi in every single Starbucks and every single McDonald's, and, you know, pretty much every fast food joint in the world at this point. So the problem is solvable. It's demonstrably solvable, but it's not, to your point, it's definitely not free. You need an operations group that knows what they're doing, that knows how to deal with abuse, that knows how to keep the network operating and do it efficiently. And we find that it can be done, but yeah, it does take a couple bucks.
Adam, I want to ask you about a related topic, because again, this is was asked in the chat room. When we think about metro wireless, how does that change from urban and rural wireless? So as we get to the less populated parts of the country, is it the same technology? Is it the same methodology? Is it the same deployment? Or does it change dramatically depending on if you're deploying into farmland or city?
Yes, it does change quite a bit. And I would say it changes dramatically. When you're in the urban environments, though you have a lot of politics that you have to overcome to be able to find mounting points for your access points or your wireless gear, there are a lot of them. There's a lot of places potentially to mount your equipment. There's light poles everywhere. There's buildings. When you get out into the rural environment, you tend to have lots of trees and a lot of space in between your users. So there's economic challenges of your user density is really, really low. So your cost per user acquisition starts going up really fast. And you want to get up really high to get your footprint out as far as possible. You're not nearly as worried about interference issues. But then you have different kind of gear that you're going to have to use. You have to stretch really far between your aggregation points and your backhaul. So you might be using larger dishes. You need to get through trees. So you might use completely different technology. You might use something with 900 megahertz or lower, you know, frequency like that can have the penetration. So yeah, it's a completely different problem set.
All right. Curtis, I've got a note here that you've got a hand up. And so I'm assuming that you're eagerly waiting to figure out what you want to say.
Yeah, it actually was for a little while ago, but, you know, we were talking about the cost going from point to point. And actually the big point I was going to make was one that was made before about the way that some of these kiosks were being used. You know, that's an issue that a lot of metropolitan areas have dealt with, even in places like public libraries. I know that public libraries are offering free Wi-Fi in many metropolitan areas. They have an issue with people going in and camping inside the public libraries, using them often for unsavory things. And here's one of those interesting cases where the federal government has said that if you take federal money to subsidize your library, then you must put certain filters on those access points in your library. Well, you get places like my community, which is heavily university-oriented. Our community decided that we would rather not take federal money than to put any filters on our access points. So we now community fund the libraries, and the access points are free and open. Lots of these issues cropping up now, but they're not unique to the external publicly available Wi-Fi.
Lou, I want to bring you in on this because, well, Microsoft has a lot of experience with this as of late. And the idea of offering a service, which sounds fantastic and it sounds wonderful, but in being the offerer of that service, you inherit legal responsibilities for what might be done with that service. This is something that hasn't really been tested on public metro networks. We're kind of seeing it in New York. We're kind of seeing their response. What do you foresee as we go into the future and more municipalities try this? What are they going to be shocked by when they need to start looking at what their service is actually being used for?
So I'm thinking it's the entry cost is probably lower than they think, but then the long-term costs are going to be higher. They're going to have, like you said, they're going to have potential lawsuits coming through. They're going to have costs to actually expand their infrastructure. There's going to be more people using it, utilizing it in different ways that they probably didn't intend them to use it. And so then they have to pay more to get them to be more efficient. You have to pay more for people to watch the networks and keep the networks up. I think it's just one of those things is you can't actually, especially free Wi-Fi systems like this, you can't determine the amount of load, the amount of traffic that's going to come on it, depending on, you know, how many people move in the city for that year, or how many businesses come in and decide to use your free Wi-Fi versus using the paid Wi-Fi sort of thing. So I think short-term costs are probably they're not a sticker shock enough to basically show what the long-term costs are going to be. So I think that's where these municipalities are going to be shocked by.
Brandon, I want to get you in on the last word here because we are running out of time. It sounds silly. It sounds ridiculous. But ultimately, and especially if we had Chibert on the show, he would say it comes down to the porn. If you think that you're actually distributing a free wireless network, if you really do want to bring open internet access, you have to be able to tolerate the porn. And that's still where we are. That's the test. If you can do that and if you can survive that, then yes, you are offering a free service. If not, then your costs go up because you have to greatly increase the amount of administration hands-on that you do with your network. And it also means you have to change the focus of what the network does. Do you run into this at all? And how do you explain that to very genteel clients?
So we've run into it, but not directly. And what I mean by that is, you know, certainly our customers have asked us questions around that. But we're not a law firm or a technology firm. We can build the technology. It's mostly up to our customers and their legal counsel for how to deal with that. But I will mention, at least in the United States, we have this concept of sovereign immunity, where generally, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but generally municipalities can't be held responsible for those sorts of things, assuming it's the municipality that actually owns the network as opposed to paying some contractor to run it. And I'd say on the second half, you know, like I said before, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of businesses today offering free Wi-Fi access. And you don't hear about big problems from Starbucks or McDonald's or even your local cafe getting sued or getting in trouble for those sorts of things. I think as long as you're a responsible user and if you cooperate with law enforcement when they have a rightful warrant to look for someone doing something bad, I think you're going to be just fine.
Indeed. I think that should be the show title. I think you're going to be just fine. Unfortunately, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 access points. I want to thank our panel for being here, for delivering all this enterprise goodness to our audience, to our Twilight Riot. Let's start with you, Adam. Where can we find you? Where can we find your work? I absolutely appreciated your insight into the technology behind Metro Wireless. Where should we find Network Utility Force?
Where should you find us? Well, we're out of Atlanta. We work all over the country. Some of my work in the past, I guess I built Wi-Fi networks for Netflix. I helped finish out the Wi-Fi network for the 9/11 Museum and Memorial. So all over the place, if that's your question.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'd love to see your work. And by the way, I got to ask, I mean, this is completely off topic. This is a tangent. I've known Brandon for more than a decade now, and I know that he is a big, how best do I put this, Brandon? He's a crook. He's a good crook, the good kind of crook. But how did you get met up with him? You seem like such a nice person.
We worked for a little startup. I guess he kind of suckered me into a startup. So it was a lot of ups and downs. You know, he's good at that, at getting people into all kind of interesting situations. So if you know him, you know how that works for him.
Oh yeah. I do. Brandon, you do have this this unique ability to gather really, really good people around you, even though, come on, let's be honest. I know you pretty well. So how are you, my friend?
I'm excellent, and I'm honored to work with such an excellent team like Adam and my partners and the other folks here at Network Utility Force. And I'm very honored by the industry with all the great things that that people have to say about us.
Well, you know, give us a little sneak peek. What kind of future project has you interested?
Oh, well, we have a proposal on the table for a very large online retailer to help them with their wireless installations in all of their warehouses and office spaces. It's a huge project for us, or we're hoping that that one comes through. But one we're just finishing up now is for a very large book publisher, a similar idea where we help them with the Wi-Fi, improving the Wi-Fi in their warehouses and in their headquarters.
Yeah. And folks, by the way, you know that Cheburn and I have talked about Interop a lot. And if you ever want to know who kept the packets flowing at Interop and going to the right place, it was Brandon Ross. Brandon, thank you again. It's always great to see you. Oh, and by the way, we have a member of our chat room, JJ to the 4884, who has been he's been tireless in his desire to bring technology, more and more technology, into Georgia, into Atlanta, into Hotlanta. So at some point, I need to connect the two of you because I think he could be a good asset for you.
Absolutely. Hey, B. Ross to netuf.net. I'm pretty easy to find. Drop me an email. Whether you're JJ, I think he said his name was, or anyone else who'd like to work on a metro wireless project or really any kind of other network infrastructure, that's what we do.
There you go. JJ, it's in your hands. Take it. It's an opportunity. Here's the golden ring. I also want to thank my co-hosts. I couldn't do this show without them. Let's start with Lou Maresca, again, a senior lead over at Microsoft's in their CRM Dynamics department. Lou, what are you doing in between diaper changes these days?
Ignite demo, ignite demo, ignite demo. So check out Ignite on the 26th of all of our CRM demos. That's what we've been working on lately.
Right. And next week, when I host Windows Weekly with Mary Jo and Paul Thurrott, and they're at Ignite, just remember, anything enjoyable came from Lou Maresca. Yeah, go back to Lou, because we need to, that's the face. This guy, that guy. Of course, my good friend, my long-term friend, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Information Week Radio. Curtis, again, a pleasure. Always so much fun to have you on the show. Could you please tell the folks what's coming up on this week of Information Week Radio?
Oh, we've actually got a bunch of interesting stuff in process. I spent much of the early part of this week in New Orleans at the convention of the Society of Professional Journalists and learned a lot in terms of technology and techniques that we'll be bringing to bear on our podcast. Now, I've got a couple of interviews in the can with executives from McDonald's and from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the people who help wheat and corn and pork bellies and all those things move around. So those are coming up. Plus, from Monday through Thursday of next week, I'm going to be in Orlando at the Splunk User Conference. Couldn't quite make it all the way up to Atlanta for Ignite, but I am going to spend some time with the Splunk folks. So there'll be some good analytical information coming out of Orlando next week.
Fantastic. Curtis, always a pleasure. And of course, thanks to you, to the person who keeps coming back each and every single week. We wouldn't have a show without your support, and we want to make it easier for you to get your dosage of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/quiet. There you'll find all of our back episodes available for download in whatever format you want, along with subscription links. If you want to support the show, if you want to see more This Week in Enterprise Tech, if you want us to keep bringing you all the best guests that Cheebert can find, please subscribe audio, video, high definition video into your device of choice automatically each week. Again, folks, this is how we keep things quiet. Also, don't forget that you can find me on my Twitter page if you want to know what we're going to be doing in the studio. If you want to know what's going on with Twit in general, or if you just want to know what I do when I'm not in the studio, you can follow me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. Don't forget that we do this show live every Friday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. That's 13:30. If you join us, you might as well jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. I pull questions directly from the chat room. Cheebert's always there, even if he's not on the show. And of course, it's a good way to interact with our guests. It's part of the experiment that is Twit TV. Finally, thank you to everyone who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo who let us do this show, to all the people in the studio, from our engineer, Kara Cole, Jammer B, and Burke, who make sure that all the electrons keep running, and of course, to my TD, Kevin. Kevin, you probably still don't have a camera on yourself, but could you tell the folks at home, what is it that you do here? You need a mic. There you go.
I press the buttons, and I DJ for all the daily parties at the end of the day with my grand piano in my cubicle.
Ah, fantastic. Okay, well, you know, Kevin, since you're my TD, the way we end the show every time is we have to ask you a question. And we're hoping that you get one of these right at some point in the near future. And this one's right up your alley. The question is, how many teeth are in the mouth of a shark that's been mutated?
Two.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. The answer was all of them. That's what the answer we were looking for. But maybe you'll get it next week. Folks, thank you again for joining us. I actually won't be with the show for the next 6 or 7 weeks. I have to do a temporary assignment in Rome, but I will be right back. You'll be in plenty good hands with the rest of the Twiat crew. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiat.